Welcome to a spring evening with a light rain. Sometimes it's said it's easier to notice the calmness and stillness when there's a little bird sound in the quiet mountains, or a light rain in the garden. Finding stillness. Essential aspect of Zen practice, of Zazen. We may not say it's the whole practice, we may say that's finding stillness of body and mind is an entrance, but we may be able to say that it's actually the whole practice is contained in stillness. Stillness doesn't necessarily mean physically still or auditorily silent, but getting in touch with the aspect of stillness and silence. And to talk about this tonight, I'd like to share with you some of this new book by my teacher, Tenshin Reb Anderson Roshi, The Third Turning of the Wheel. This just came out. It's a commentary on the sutra unfurling the deep intimacy of the Buddha's teaching, the Sanghi Nirmo Chana Sutra. So it's a cause for great celebration for me, as this book was collected from these talks, years and years, I think over a decade of talks on this particular sutra, which many of us had to sit through again and again, these same chapters. Sometimes we spend maybe a couple years getting halfway through, and then our teacher would say, actually, I think we should go back to the beginning, start again. And eventually, we made it through this sutra of the Buddha. I think that if you actually transcribed and published all the talks, the book would be about this thick. So it's like the best of. The Third Turning of the Wheel. And I share this with you too because we've also had classes on this sutra maybe a couple years ago here, and more recently on the Lankavatara Sutra, which is very, very related to this Unraveling the Deep Intimacy Sutra. It's also considered a Third Turning of the Dharma Wheel Sutra, which briefly we could say is the, in this case, the teaching is that everything is merely projections of mind. Nothing can be found outside mind, and a lot can be said about that, of course, but the purpose of such teaching is to find the stillness and silent nature of mind. Still and silent because it's not disturbed by an external world. which is basically what we're disturbed by. If we're disturbed, these third turning teachings would say that we're disturbed by grasping a seemingly external world, a world apart from mind. And this is the practice and realization of suchness. The suchness of things. Things as they are. Things as it is. But things, in this third turning, are not external to mind. But suchness emphasizes kind of the way things are. The way things are is that they're of the nature of mind. Whereas working back to the second turning of the Dharma wheel is more about how things are not. Things are not. Like the Heart Sutra says, there's no eyes, no ears. That's the second turning teaching. Third turning is that there are eyes and ears, but they're not apart from mind. They're not separate from mind. And the first turning would be more just like that there are eyes and ears. Very practical first turning teaching. There are eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and so on. And let's get very familiar with how they work. So that's a nice way to start practice. Setting in motion the wheel of Dharma, the first turning, then seeing that there are no eyes, no ears, no nose, tongue, body, and mind. And then the third turning is the suchness of eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, which is that they're non-dual with mind. They're not separate from mind. So this commentary just goes through the sutra, so I'm just picking up a later chapter here that's about the practice of calming the mind, specifically about sitting meditation practice, the practice of tranquility, which in this sutra is very wonderfully linked to nothing apart from mind. When we find a tranquility of calm abiding, it's found along with the fact that the objective world is not apart from mind. So this is a question, this is a section commenting on the chapter 8 of the sutra, and it's this question is called the Questions of Yangshan, which is a Zen story brought in here. I'll just read a little bit from this commentary. In the Zen tradition, there are innumerable stories that center on working with the practice of calming the mind in tranquility. For example, Yangshan asked the monk, "Where were you born?" And the monk replied, "Yu province." Province in China. Yangshan said, "Do you think of that place?" And the monk replied, "I'm always thinking of it." Yangshan said, "That which thinks is the mind. That which is thought of is the environment. In that environment, in that thought of, that objective world, there are such things as mountains, rivers, the great earth, towers and buildings, people and animals." And the list goes on and on. All the things in the environment. But now, think back to the mind that thinks, Yangshan says. So this monk says, I'm always thinking about my home province, you province, and all these other things in the environment. If I'm not thinking about that, I'm thinking about towers and pavilions and dogs and cats and whatever. And so Yangshan says, now try this other practice of think back to the mind that thinks. Look back at the awareness that's actually thinking of all these objects. Next he asked the monk, then is there something there? And the monk said, when I reach this realm, I don't see anything at all. So that's the Zen story from the Book of Serenity that's being brought up here. And Tenshin Roshi says, thinking of that place, like that place, you province, refers to the way the mind works. The mind is always thinking of where it has been before. There is living experience, but living experience is not thought of. So there is a living experience right now, our life of the moment, but it's not thought of. When we think of our experience, it then becomes a kind of past event. Just a little bit past, maybe, or a lot past. What is thought of is our past. We're always thinking of our past. And then he says, there's another meaning of always thinking of you, province. We always think back to the origin of our experience. We always think of where our experience is born. So this is he's going to bring up this teaching from this sutra about where experience is born from. How's the temperature doing in here? It's pretty warm in here. If anyone would like to open a window a little bit, and that way we can hear the spring rain a little too. We're always thinking of where our experience is born. We are both yearning for and thinking about the place we come from, which is the basis of our thinking. We don't necessarily know we are yearning for it, but we do want to go back to it. Origin of our thinking, because that place is the home of our thinking. In this sutra, the home of our thinking is called, anyone want to guess? Yes! Ah, Gold Star Zen student who's been listening to teachings on mind only. Yes, Alaya, or the storehouse consciousness, the repository consciousness, is the home of our thinking. So this is kind of interesting. You don't really hear this in the sutra. This is this commentary that we're both yearning for and thinking about the place we come from, which is the basis of our thinking. He's kind of implying that I'm thinking of you, province, is really like I'm thinking about the storehouse consciousness, which is like murky and unclear, cloudy, and we can't actually ever see or experience the storehouse consciousness directly, according to these teachings. It's like the equivalent of, in Western psychology, we call the unconscious. So by definition, we can't experience the unconscious except as it manifests in our conscious experience, which this alaya, this storehouse consciousness, is constantly churning up mountains, rivers, dogs and cats that we can't experience. Or I should say, yeah, it's churning up dogs and cats. I'd say, well, dogs and cats are like emerging out of the storehouse consciousness. If you haven't heard this before, I know it's weird, but that's the teaching of mind only. When you experience a dog, a cat, a mountain, or a river, your experience of that dog is brought to you straight from the storehouse consciousness. We might want to go back into the storehouse and see, like, what's it look like in there before it manifests in this dog form? Impossible. We can't go there. But interestingly, Tenzin Roshi says, we're actually yearning for this place where we come from, which is the basis of our thinking. So in this sutra, and the Lankavatara Sutra also, the home of our thinking is called the storehouse consciousness, alaya. Our thinking of you, province, functions on two levels. On an active conscious level, we're thinking in terms of reflections of past experience. And on the most subtle and deeply subconscious level, we are supported by the results of our past action, namely the storehouse consciousness, alaya. So, thinking of you, province, has this conscious aspect of, like, we're imagining our hometown. We all have some hometown. We can imagine an image from the past because we have seeds for this image in the storehouse consciousness. And then, on this other level, our hometown is actually stored in the storehouse consciousness. But that version of it, it's in seed form. We can't experience our actual hometown until it emerges, until that seed sprouts. And even then, of course, is it our actual hometown? When we're thinking about it, about across the country, or, you know, we'd say, well, of course not, we're just thinking about it, but what about when we're actually there in our hometown? Is that our actual hometown? Or is that a sprouted seed from the storehouse of past memories of that town? I say, well, what about before we've ever been there before we have any memories, the first time we set foot in our hometown? Still, there's all this unconscious predispositions for relating to it as our hometown. So then, skipping ahead a little bit, Yangshan then gives the monk the instruction we've been looking at, think back to the mind that thinks. This could also be translated as reverse your thought and think of the ability to think. Like, we have an ability to think, so we're actually thinking of the ability to think. This is the basic instruction offered in the koan, and Yangshan follows it with a question. Then, is there something there? And by the way, you've heard this kind of thing before, I know some of you, but, you know, we have our essential instructions for Zazen by Dogen Zenji. He says the essential art of Zazen is thinking of not thinking. Or we could say, think of what is not thinking, which is the same instruction as think of what thinks. Sounds opposite, right? Think of what doesn't think and think of what thinks, but it's the same source of mind that can either think or not think. In both cases, it's looking back. It's reversing the tendency of mind to think of things out there. It's looking back at the thinker and or the non-thinker, which is kind of a very unusual thing to do, because we like our world, and we like relating to our world, and it's kind of temporarily in Zazen not really relating to our world, at least in the usual way, to reverse the thought that's thinking of dogs and cats and look at the mind that thinks of dogs and cats. Very challenging too. So Yangshan follows this instruction with the question, then is there something there when you think back to the ability to think? Within Yangshan's setup, this question leads us to realize liberation from entanglement with objects. in the context of turning the mind and thinking of the mind that thinks, the question opens to experiencing the world around us as nothing other than mind. Now, some of you have heard this kind of thing before, and you might say, like, yeah, yeah, I've heard that before. If you haven't heard that before, that might sound like a huge leap. Like, what? Wait, I missed something there. I'll read again. To ask this question, is there something there when you look back at the source of mind? This question leads us to realize liberation from entanglement with objects. That makes sense, right? All the dogs and cats that we were thinking about, now we're just engaged with the mind that's thinking of them, so we're not entangled with the objects out here. In the context of turning the mind back, turning the light around, we also say, and thinking of the mind that thinks, the question opens, the question, is there something there? That question opens us to experiencing the world around us as nothing other than mind. In turning the mind this way, all our obsessions of body and mind drop away. We are all just one turning of the mind away from entering such a realm, the realm of suchness, or the realm of cognition only, or mind only. I appreciated that point. We're all just one turning of the mind away from it. Realization of everything is mind only sounds like this huge undertaking, like very, you know, how many steps would we have to go through to realize that the Zendo is mind only? But in this case, we're only one turning away from it. The turning that's like the awareness that's looking out at the Zendo out there, we're just this one turning away from realizing that the Zendo is mind only. This one turning that's turning the awareness back to the source that's aware of the Zendo. And you know, there's no explanation at this point, although you could, the whole sutra unravels this intimacy of non-separation of mind and objects. But experientially, maybe without explaining much more, it's something that we can check out in Zazen to turn the awareness around, or we might even just say, let the awareness like rest back into the thinker, the ability to think. And when we're attending there, then our relationship with what's being attended to is totally different. We are all just one turning of the mind away from entering such a realm, the realm of suchness, the realm of cognition only. And the monk follows this instruction thoroughly and answers Yang Shan's question by saying, when I reach this realm, I don't see anything at all. He is not saying that there is nothing, but just that everything is mind. Gold star. So he doesn't see anything. There's just mind. I don't know how long you practice these instructions before giving his answer. For some students, it may be a week. For others, it may be years. And some may respond immediately and say, when I reach this realm, I don't see anything at all. In the first part of the story, the monk disengages himself from objects. He does not see the world as external, and his mind is undisturbed. This is the initiation into objectlessness. It's not that there are no externals. Interesting, huh? It's not that there are no externals. We've had some discussions about this. It's not that there are no externals. It's just that they are the mind appearing that way. Now that this monk has been doing this practice, now that he has got to this place, now that he's totally settled in this realm of objectlessness, it is as if there is nothing at all. Not really nothing at all, but as if there is nothing at all, because there is nothing truly separate from the mind. This is what happens when we look at the ability to think. When we look at the mind which is contemplated by any mind, we don't find anything. And that's a phrase from the sutra that is commented on earlier. It's another version of the same thing, looking at the mind which can be contemplated by any mind. The mind contemplated by any mind is a non-conceptual image. So the ability to think is also it's not like we're going to find it in this, like there's a little movie projector back there or something, like, and like we go through this dark tunnel and there it is, the movie projector. Oh, there it is. What brand name does it have on there? It's actually, unfortunately, that would be very nice, right? If we could go back there and find it, the brand name of the projector. But actually, it's a non-conceptual image. The ability to think is, it's not like we're going to find it in any conceivable way. That's why it's so hard to turn the light around this way. Because we're thinking that we're looking for something, but actually, it's not a thing. The thinker is not a thing. What doesn't think is not a thing. What thinks is not a thing. But the thought of the environment, the thought of, that's a thing. That's a bunch of things. Dogs and cats and raindrops and birds. The mind contemplated by any mind is a non-conceptual image. As the story continues, Yangshan tells the monk, this is good for the stage of faith. What he says in the original koan, he says, this is good for the stage of faith, but not for the stage of person. Strange Zen talk. Isn't it good enough if actually like to find that source of mind? Well, it's good for the stage of faith. And the original koans are not explained and they're not common Zen terms, so they're left as kind of something to investigate ourselves. Finding nothing at all is good for the stage of faith, but not for the stage of person. Or in other words, so Tenshin Roshi's comment on this is, in other words, as Asanga said, one of the Indian Yogacara teachers, you have faithfully done the practice of tranquility or calm abiding. You've reached this settledness where the mind is, nothing's really happening back there at the source. And by this practice of tranquility, you have entered the mind that doesn't find anything. But this is not yet the stage of person, which needs maybe something more than tranquility, than mere tranquility. In practicing the instruction to turn the light around and shine it back, we make a transition from looking at objects and thinking about them to concentrating on the uninterrupted mind. That's another phrase from this Unraveling the Mystery Sutra. Attending to the uninterrupted mind. There's some aspect of mind that's actually not changing. And it just occurs to me right now that I don't know if it's the same thing, but that just seems related to, or it comes to mind due to a seed just sprouting and from this alaya consciousness, that the uninterrupted mind is kind of like the storehouse consciousness. The alaya, the storehouse consciousness, part of its definition is that it's flowing like a river, like while we're asleep. And even in between lives and so on, this storehouse flow is uninterrupted. It's part of why it was actually taught in these third turning teachings, is that to account for times when it seems like our life is interrupted, like when we're in a deep dreamless sleep. It seems like the mind is not operating, so why don't we just die? Well, some of these third turning people say we don't die because we have this storehouse consciousness that's uninterrupted, or like in a deep coma, you could say, when consciousness, the usual mental consciousness and the sense consciousnesses are all shut down, but we're still alive. One story is that it's this alaya, the storehouse, is keeping us alive. It's the uninterrupted mind. So, as I said, we can't actually see the alaya directly, but as a practice exercise, it could be talked about as like looking back to the source, this uninterrupted source from which everything comes out of. And we can't see it, but that's what this monk saw. He said, when I get here, I don't see anything at all. So it may be that turning the light around and shining back at this, at the ability to think, is like settling the mind in back into the storehouse from which it all comes, which is a non-conceptual storehouse. So, this is quite a challenging book, I think. even though it's commenting on a challenging sutra, it's trying to unravel this sutra that's trying to unravel the Buddha's intention. But such teachings are challenging. They're not the usual way we think. So, yes. That seems very similar, yeah. The ability to think sounds like the witness, being the witness of 10,000 things. Now we might ask people who teach this witness thing, well, what do you mean exactly by the witness? And then we could see, is it... completely non-conceptual witness? Is it is the witness something that that when we actually be it or look directly at it, that we actually don't see anything at all? If that's the case, then maybe very similar. Which I think usually is the way that they talk about the witness. It's not something that you finally find, like, oh, here it is, the witness. Yeah, and similarly, challenging to do, because we're wired as human beings. Our very systems are like wired to engage in this objective world of things and seemingly external objects. And there's another chapter section in here called the Bodhisattva Surfer. That's nice for Santa Cruz people. That's talks about something like it's not necessarily that we have to remain in this completely tranquil place where nothing's happening, because actually, you know, we have an active life, and bodhisattvas need to be active and engaged with this world. We can't just like sit there in the cushion, kind of like turning back the awareness. You know, we can temporarily, but we can't forever. So how do we, as bodhisattvas, engage in this very complicated so-called world that's not separate from mind, that's often very dynamic? So that's the image of the bodhisattva surfer. Roshi says, I often use the image of surfing the ocean of mind. It's not so much that you try to make the mind ocean smooth, Although sometimes the mind ocean can become flat due to some kind of deep yogic concentration practice, what I'm concerned about is being upright and relaxed with the movement of the mind, so you're able to ride the fluctuations with complete stillness and balance, like a skillful surfer. The skillful surfers are interacting with forces of nature that are constantly changing and challenging their balance, and yet they find equanimity in the impermanent flux of their mind and body in relationship to its environment. There is stillness, there is imperturbability in the midst of constant change. The question is, in the midst of such great flux, with the water splashing and the waves flowing all around you, can you remember the teaching that this is just mind looking at mind? To understand the teaching in the midst of the waves is different from understanding the teaching in a classroom. To remember the teaching under those conditions requires both the teachings from the classroom about mind only and tranquil concentration. So together, these are united. Tranquil concentration, but doesn't mean like everything's totally still. Maybe very huge, breaking wave that we're barely balanced on. So maybe a less dramatic example of that is like when you hear the sound of the birds or the light rain, and it's actually it not only doesn't disturb you, but it actually like settles you more into stillness. A little bit of movement, external, objective happening out there sometimes can enliven us a little bit in the midst of the stillness. We don't need total silence, literal silence. And then maybe we can actually then go actually surfing on big waves. Yes? Grandiose in what way?
Like I feel like I'm letting people down, but then when I'm working or if I'm letting myself down. But then I can just sort of throw it that far.
Grandiose meaning like the problems of the external world seem like they're overwhelming you or get really big.
Yeah.
Exaggerated even.
Yeah.
I think in a way that's what we all tend to do to greater or lesser extent. As soon as we believe that there's an external world apart from mind, it automatically we start to make everything grandiose, at least a little bit, and we can't help it. It gets bigger, or maybe sometimes smaller. We also try to avoid it or diminish it instead of relating to it as this is just the actual projection of mind in this moment. It's not bigger or smaller than it appears. But then in the point about fear, I think you mentioned quite wisely that fear is stored in the storehouse consciousness. That's where, fear of certain things is because of our karmic dispositions in our own storehouse. So certain people are afraid of some things and others are afraid of other things, and they're different due to our unique karmic seeds. So recognizing that is already a big step, and to notice that actually the reason I'm afraid of this apparently external object is because of these internal stored tendencies. So just knowing that and recognizing that is already like a big step, because it's a little bit like turning back, turning around a little bit. It's instead of saying that object is totally frightening, it's more like actually the fear is not in the object out there. The fear is like in the storehouse that's projecting the object, kind of overlaid with a projection of fear. So the whole thing becomes workable, even though maybe very challenging, and how we're going to work with it, we'll have to work that out. But just opening to the possibility that the whole thing is not, it's not so split into this external. If things were really external, we wouldn't be able to work with them really. Actually, right? We wouldn't be able to. They would just be doing their own thing. But if we see that the way that the world is appearing is is our own projected way that it's appearing, then the whole thing becomes workable. Still, it's work. But everything is possible in this realm of mind only.
I find in my experience now that the whole model of external and internal, or there's no difference between external and internal, is just confusing. But what I find less confusing, I was about to say you will find it less confusing, but is the idea of continuity and discontinuity. In the sense that my consciousness is always active. We meditate with our eyes open, and our ears open, and really open. So consciousness, as I understand it, is always active. And here's birds, and here's cars. And
well, there are the so-called active consciousnesses, and then inactive ones, like Alaya.
Well,
is an inactive consciousness, right?
We it's a placeholder for something.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is active, in addition to my consciousness being active. I'm naming things. I'm distinguishing things. I'm putting values on things. I'm scaring myself to death. Or death is scaring me to something. And I find out projecting this continuity. I was looking out that window and it was still open and there was a lovely flower out there. And as soon as I said, that's a lovely flower, I was projecting this continuity. It was like the flower and then everything else. And I do that with me too. It was me and it was everything else. And I think sometimes what I'm hearing in our attempts to image this is, you know, we're in some mystical way, Alaya is making all this up for us. You know, it's all in our mind. And I don't think that's necessary to feel that way, because ethically, however, I can see, if I just cease projecting discontinuity by saying, I like that, I don't like that, this should be this way and not that way, this is a bowl, not a scorpion trap, all that stuff is useful for stopping at red lights. But that common biting I hear you talking about is just stilling the mind in the presence of a totally active consciousness. At which point, that still mind does not identify the observer.
Yeah, when you talk about creating discontinuities, it's basically any conceptual thought is creating a discontinuity, right?
Yeah, it's my argument with Vipassana is that when I am looking at my mind, I am creating a discontinuity. If I am just allowing consciousness to be consciousness and stilling my mind and taking the sitting posture to practice doing that, the I goes away.
Yeah, so if we think of there's some me that's going to turn the light of awareness back, that just makes another separation.
Yeah, and it is a self-limiting practice.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be abandoned.
So it's tricky, you know, there's all different ways to talk about it, and yeah. That's good that you point out that problem with potential problem with saying, now I'm going to do this exercise of looking back to think of the ability to think. It's like we can get into this whole separation.
It begs that question again.
Yeah, but I think the actual instruction, though it can sound that way, and any instruction in words is going to have problems, right? So I would understand that what it means is actually, it's an instruction that's kind of clunky because it's in words, but to actually, the process of starting to do it is just more like a letting go of our kind of the turmoil of relating to an external world temporarily and just resting. But it's a different way of putting it. And I think maybe part of the way, reason for putting it that way is because if we say the words, just let go and rest here, then that also could have problems. So it's nice to have all the problems there could be that we just fall asleep or something, you know, for example. So I think that's why in Zen there's many, many meditation instructions that are often saying the same thing, but in ways that sound really different.
Tell me if I understood you correctly. You said, we're all here, and suddenly you use the word, you said, is the Zendo really here?
Mm-hmm.
If Zendo is only is mind only, the label Zendo is mind only. As soon as what is here becomes a Zendo, that's mind only. There's no doubt about that. However, one could just be still and be conscious of all the stimulation that's coming in and have absolutely no name for it.
Mm-hmm. And in that way, you could say it's not a Zendo.
It's not a Zendo.
So even though it sounds really strange to think when I get here, I don't see anything at all, mm-hmm. We might think, well, that must be a really deep mystical experience. But actually, maybe quite ordinary. It's just like when we're really engaged in the presence of Zazen, really on the tip of that breaking wave of the present, then it's as if there's no thing there at all. It's like we're not actually in a Zendo for maybe just a moment. And then often that's the time when we suddenly notice the wave, and it's like, whoa, get a hold of this, you know, I'm just balanced on the edge of this, get a hold of the surfboard, and then immediately there's the surfboard, there's the wave, we're back in the Zendo. So maybe just a tiny moment when there's no Zendo.
So bells and clackers are to get us somehow shocked.
Sometimes they can do that, and sometimes they can have the opposite effect, like we're really settled and there's no Zendo, and suddenly there's the clack, and we're like, why did somebody do the clackers? So, there's no set way. Fortunately, very nice, there's no set way, because then we can just keep practicing and it'll always be fresh and something new. If there was only one way, it would get very boring. Even though there actually is only one way. One vehicle, one mind. So I hope to get a little commission for advertising this book. I'll ask my teacher. I'll say I did a whole talk and quoted it, and it's $18.95. You can probably get it for less, various places. Yep. And we have a copy in the library of the Zen Center. So, thank you for being here, appearing here, letting me project you. Thank you for projecting me. Otherwise, what would we do? May all beings be free from belief in truly separate external world and enter the vast ocean of eternal brightness. Beings. beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.